now a hurricane, an attorney hurricane. Too tight, no loving you.
Loving you.
Konya wa hurricane. Kanji de hurricane. Suga o mama touch. Gimme touch.
No, Jared. No touch for you. thank you for coming back to Old Talking No Radio. We don't know why you do, but today today we're talking about the landmark cyberpunk anime OVA series, Bubblegum Crisis, which recently celebrated its 30th anniversary, or somewhat recently. With me today is my co-host and cohort in crime, Mr. Jared Nelson.
Hi, I'm Jared. I'm not excited at all.
And we also have a very special guest, Mr. Doug Wyman of the Animated Action Podcast, who's actually going to tell you a little bit about Bubblegum Crisis.
The streets of Mega Tokyo roil with gangs, violence, and crazed artificial cyborgs known as boomers. When even the highly trained and well-equipped AD police are no match, it falls to four female vigilantes to keep the peace. In their advanced hard suits, these warriors of justice will become known as the Night Sabers.
Beautiful.
That was amazing.
I am so excited to talk about this.
Oh my god, I'm so excited. I'm so excited. I am ready. I was lying earlier. I'm so ready. I've been ready. I've been ready. This is one of my favorite things ever. This is going to be amazing. I'm going to try not to talk even more than I normally do.
You look ready.
There's excitement.
Whew.
Excitement.
So why is this your favorite thing ever? And why are you so excited to talk about it?
Bubblegum Crisis is one of, I want to say, let me think. It was probably the fifth thing I saw getting into anime fandom. I saw it in the original Animego releases. My older brother, who I occasionally shout out as being sort of my my guy who was the gateway keeper into my anime fandom, he picked up Bubblegum Crisis, one volume of VHS at a time. You know, eight VHS tapes back then, and I devoured it. It was so good. You know, that was really one of my, probably my first real exposure to cyberpunk, to like really think about cyberpunk as a genre, which is a genre I've grown to love over the years. And there's so much about it that's awesome. There's incredible mecha designs. There's really great action. It was kind of unique at the time. Unique maybe isn't the best word, but it stood out for having a cast of female protagonists that were like the badasses in the power armor, kicking the crap out of, you know, big cyborg monsters. And it was just really cool. I mean, the whole damn show, just top to bottom, was really cool. So, you know, in the early 90s, you know, 13, 14 year old me, yeah, I'm digging the crap out of this show. So yeah, I mean, it's just a formative show for me. Kind of like my other beloved Macross is a formative show for me.
Now, what about you, Doug? You jumped at the opportunity to talk about this. What is it that appealed to you so much?
It is everything that I love. Period, pretty much. It has that old school rock and roll sound. It has the robot action I crave. It is just explosive. Ugh, God, I love it. I still remember the first time I saw it, too. It was a perfect atmosphere for it. It was, I think, the first time I went to Otakon. And I just stopped into one of the screening rooms. The one I hung out around the most was showing a lot of older stuff, Kamen Rider V3, Gatchaman, and then Bubblegum Crisis starts up, and I'm watching it. I'm just like, this is one of the coolest things I have ever seen.
Ink, had you ever seen Bubblegum Crisis before now?
I saw, I want to say like the first OVA, I'm not completely sure, because it was in my local video store, Dayton Video, when that still existed, and I remember going to check it out and not really being into it at all. I just remembered thinking, oh, well, the girl with the pink legs is hot. And that,
well,
that
I didn't want to get onto that. I thought it was a little crap, but you know, when you're like 15 years old and you see Bubblegum Crisis for the first time, and you see, like, of course, the explosions, the robots, and all of the women,
the cartoon boobs.
It's sex, violence, and rock and roll.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Ooh, that should have been a tagline.
But I mean, I remember not being enthralled with it at all. But that's why I was actually kind of really hoping, or really enthused about doing this podcast, because I wanted to go back and remember how I was remembering it wrong. And
I looked for your name on the Kickstarter Blu-ray. Couldn't find it.
Won't find mine.
This has been a beloved anime, I think, in American fandom for quite a while. As we mentioned the Kickstarter just a moment ago, you had the original VHS release back in the day with Animego. There was a DVD release, I think, at some point, but I'm not 100% certain. And then, you know, I mean, it's been that long. But then, you know, this was one of those things that I just, you know, watched it, you know, from my brother's collection. So I was like, I'll just watch whenever. And then VHS went away. So that busted a hole in my plan. Well, that, and he grew up and moved out. That also busted another hole in my plans. But anyway.
How many of the DVD releases did you own?
Actually, I didn't. I did not own one of them. But it was, it just stuck with me for a long time. And, you know, a lot of people, other fans, other friends of mine that I encountered had copies of it, so I would watch that too. So I've been able to keep in touch with it over the years, but I've never owned a copy of it myself until the Blu-ray campaign. Actually, no, I take that back. I did have a dubbed VHS copy. Somebody randomly for Christmas one year got me a dubbed VHS copy of Scoop Chase. So I did have that one.
All the episodes.
Hey, man. It was a Nene episode. That's, you know, Nene's awesome. But anyway, so the Kickstarter campaign happened in 2013, I think, by pretty much any measure, a strong success. Now we have Bubblegum Crisis on Blu-ray, and you can go buy it today if you want to.
Actually, no, you can't. You can't get the Blu-ray anymore. I tried to get it for a friend this past Christmas, but
are you serious?
They only made just enough for the Kickstarter and a few leftovers.
The DVD is all you can get.
So, yeah, but the DVDs are.
Oh, flattable. Man. Wow. Yeah. I'm just now seeing that.
You don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. Oh. So I have an out of print Ultimate Edition Blu-ray set. That's cool.
You do.
I can feel leet this one time. Okay, so yes, thank you for that. You can go to Animego's website, and I think you can get it on Right Stuff too, and get yourself the DVD box set for $30. It's great. You should do it. It's just go buy it. If you have never seen it for some reason, stop what you're doing, stop listening, and go buy it, and then come back and listen. Let's talk about the pedigree that this show has in terms of, you know, the time it came out in. The staff, you know, just the general sort of time frame. This started out, the series of OVAs came out in the late 80s. I think 87 was when the first one came out. And it's the original run, the original series is 8 volumes, and it finished coming out in 91. So pretty interesting time in Japan's history. Socially, and then also just an interesting kind of transitory time in terms of anime itself. You know, you're starting to see the beginnings of the future, you know, of the 90s by the time it started wrapping up. So you guys have any thoughts about just animation in general from that time and sort of how Bubblegum Crisis fits into that milieu before we dig in a little deeper?
Bubble era of direct-to-video animation, because they had money to throw around. They were freely giving lifetime employment opportunities to fresh hires at pretty much every big corporation in Japan. So they were able to just throw all this money at Bubblegum Crisis mm-hmm. and make the best damn thing that they could. And they did.
Yeah. I think that part of its name comes from the time in which it was released. Oddly enough, it's sort of self-referential. The bubblegum era of Japan, like right before the real estate bubble burst and kind of right as it was bursting, starting to burst there by the end of the run. But yeah, it's an interesting time.
You think that's reflected in the settings, the sort of mega cities and the desolated countrysides? And...
Mega City 1, home of the lawless, maintained by the judges.
You were saying, Ink?
I was asking a question. do you think the time when this was set actually was sort of forecasting that bursting of the bubble a little later on?
I mean, I think by the point that this was coming out, I think people had begun to understand that there was a real estate bubble in Japan at the time, and that was a topic of conversation, I think, in the late 80s in terms of what was then contemporary issues in Japan. And I think the creators behind the series just saw that as a kind of a springboard into creating their own world, a lot like so many anime did during the height of the Cold War, when it was like, you know, it's 20XX and the world's been nuked to death and here's all this stuff that's going on. And I mean, you know, we just got done talking about Kashern, which doesn't trace itself back to that kind of calamity specifically, but has that same kind of feel to it, you know, this post-apocalyptic kind of thing. So I think Bubblegum Crisis also kind of takes a similar tack, except it ties itself very closely to Japanese society. And it you see throughout the whole series that there's these glittering spires and just super impressive you know, architecture in parts of Mega Tokyo, where Genom has like rebuilt the whole of Tokyo basically. But at the same time, there are all these places of abject poverty too. So I think it is, you know, kind of speaking a bit to the vast economic disparity that the bubble economy could create. And yeah, I don't think it got it got it all right, of course, but you know, we don't have a giant volcano looking building in the middle of Tokyo right now. But you know, who knows? The 2020 Olympics is coming, so maybe Akira's got it right and everybody else got it wrong. But yeah, I think that I do think it was trying to not give super extensive social commentary, but it was saying a few things about you know, a city under pressure, a people in a society under pressure, and I think you can see that kind of in the different stories we get throughout the series. It also has Blade Runner look all over it, all over it. Like, these guys really liked Blade Runner, and I think that they wanted to basically make an anime Blade Runner. And that's why, I mean, there's so much inspiration from Blade Runner to the point where one of the main character, arguably the main character, is named Pris. Her band is the Replicants, and she even kind of has the hair from Pris in Blade Runner. So, I mean, it's, you know, the homages are pretty explicit to that great, great classic movie.
If I remember right, one of the reasons Bubblegum Crisis was kicked off was to kickstart Pris's actor, Kaneko Omori, her music career.
Yeah, that's right. She was an honest-to-goodness Japanese rock and roll star in the 80s. She was the front woman of a band named Silk. And the production company that did Bubblegum Crisis, UMAX, was actually an anime production company and a record label. So how much more bubble can you get than a company that does both of those things? But
Bubblegum Crisis producing bubblegum pop music.
Exactly. But for what it's worth, I think some pretty good 80s J-rock poppy kind of music.
There's a lot of good music in the series. There's no denying it. My 80s child was screaming with like,
and it's so damned 80s, this music. I mean, just to the synthesizers and everything, just, you know, growing up in that era, man, it really takes you back. And I don't know what it does to people who didn't experience that, but I'd be curious to know. It is very, very like peak 80s in a lot of ways, not just the music, but the animation itself, the way characters are designed by the great and powerful Kenichi Sonoda, who I love. He's right up there with Mikimoto in terms of my favorite character designers. God bless that man. But the designs look so 80s too. It's just like peak. Everything about it to me is peak 80s, even though it comes out right at the end of the 80s.
I'd like to say I wouldn't say, I mean, obviously the character designs are 80s, but I like the fact that the hair, the dress, all that really makes it the 80s, as opposed to the animation character designs making it the 80s, because my god, the jackets, the pants, the big hair, the flares, the studs, you know, it's like, oh, I remember this.
Yeah.
It's that very Blade Runner look, and also a lot of it lends itself to the movie Streets of Fire, which was an American movie directed by Walter Hill, who made one of my favorites, The Warriors, and was a humongous hit in Japan. Like, it cannot be stated how big of a cult movie it became there.
Why have we yet to get a The Warriors anime? Because I would kill for the Warriors anime.
There are so many anime productions of 80s movies that were supposed to be made that just didn't. Like, Production IG was working on an Escape from New York anime, all just about Snake Plissken and his nihilistic gun-toting adventures.
But Escape from LA is already
North Star Productions. North Star Productions, the company that was doing the Fist of the North Star movies for a little while, were slated to work on a Mad Max movie, but nothing's become of it.
Yeah, so a couple of interesting things about Bubblegum Crisis. It was originally planned to be 13 episodes, but the times kind of caught up with it, and due to budgets and various things with some of the cast too. The run was cut, you know, mainly budgets, but the run was cut to just 8 episodes, which are the ones we got. And I think Bubblegum Crash was sort of made in a kind of half-ass attempt to finish off the story, quote unquote.
Wasn't it a lawsuit that ended the series?
I think so. I know that, that couple of the production companies, I think Artemic and Yomix, got kind of in a tizzy with each other. And you know, like many things back in those days, there were a lot, and I think even back today too. Yeah. there's a lot of joint rights being held, and that led to problems. It was originally meant to be 13 and was just 8. And the kind of genesis of it all was one of the creators wanted to remake a 1982 film called Technopolice 21C, but he met with some of the who would become future collaborators, and I think the gentleman's name was Toshimichi Suzuki. I'm having real trouble speaking Japanese names today. It's tough. Anyway, he met with Junji Fujita, who is a big Crave mastermind behind Bubblegum Crisis, and they came up with the idea to do Bubblegum Crisis instead. Thank God. So we have it. But they had on staff some like really, you know, incredible people. So like we mentioned Sonoda earlier, the mechanical design was by Masami Obari, who, God bless that man.
Oh yeah,
you know, great mechanical designer. Also directed Fatal Fury the Motion Picture, one of the best fighting movie anime ever made. Yes, you can fight me at your pleasure on that one. And then
what else does it have to compete with?
I mean, right. And then also Shinji Aramaki doing production design work. I mean, that's some serious talent all working on one thing. And especially in the early episodes where the budget was still like really high, it shows, because those early episodes look gorgeous. They look great. Even today, by today's standards, the animation looks very, very good.
By the way, you mentioned Obari directing episodes 5 and 6, Moonlight Rambler and Red Eyes.
Yes.
Which are two of the best episodes, and that's
they are
gold among gold because of how good this series is. But I can test that Sylvie from Moonlight Rambler, her design is pure Obari. I can't believe that Sonoda designed that character.
Maybe they collaborated a bit. She does look very much like a character Obari would put together. I love 5 and 6 were growing up my favorite episodes. That storyline with Sylvie and Largo, and the fights in that are so good, and you can really see Obari all over that, in the way that when people are jumping and flipping and spinning around, it's got his fingerprints all over it, especially the action. And he does a great job with that. Some other directors that were involved were Katsuhito Akiyama, who did Golf Force and Bastard.
Golf Force also had very Sonoda designs.
Sonoda designs. Akiyama also did Bastard. He did Guyver, the 2005 Guyver.
I'm glad you specified.
Yeah, not the old one that came out. Yeah, not the good one. Yeah, I like that one. The one I got that all on US renditions tapes, I think. Or maybe Manga Core. I can't remember. I'm old. Inazuma 11 and Beyblade also, to that man's credits. Hiroaki Goda did several of the episodes, later episodes, I believe. Obari specifically directed all of 5 and all of 6. And then I think the rest of the directors stepped in when I kind of took turns. Hiroaki Goda also did basically all of All My Goddess, just anything that's All My Goddess, he did it. Let's see.
Episode 8, I think it was the animation was mainly directed by Satoshi Urashihara, Mr. Plastic People, who is best known for doing Plastic Little, but is not as well known for directing or being the series director for the original Transformers cartoon.
Hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, the last episode has a slightly different look to it to me. I noticed that today for the first time.
It's probably the least plastic looking thing he's ever done, but it's still notable.
Yeah, it looks a lot cleaner. I don't know if that's the best terminology to describe it. Everything looks a lot more clearly defined, a lot bolder, a lot smoother.
No, I agree. It's not as grimy or
not nearly as gritty. And it fits that episode because it's a much more lighthearted episode than some of the earlier stuff. But Shinji Aramaki directed, I think still holds up as one of my favorite, maybe my favorite overall, Revenge Road episode 4 with
I love that one.
The living car. Yeah. Oh man. We're diving really deep on the talent here, but that's just to reinforce the fact that lots of really good people who've gone on to do some pretty landmark stuff have been involved with Bubblegum Crisis. In terms of like voice actors, we mentioned Kinoko Omori earlier. And then, of course, good old Shuichi Ikeda is in there for a few episodes as Brian J. Mason before he gets vaporized and then gets reincarnated as a super death boomer. Shuichi Ikeda, for those of you who don't know, been living under a rock, he's Shar Aznable from Gundam. So there you go. Just like top-notch talent, like so much top-notch talent across the board.
So much. In fact, you take a look at both the production cast or the production crew and the voice cast, and you have the basis for an anime Hall of Fame.
I'm not hearing any famous writers, because one of the, like, this show is awesome, and I love to watch it happen, and I love to hear it happen. But one thing I really just couldn't get behind was basically any of the stories, because all the stories were just sort of, eh, they were popish, like, they were throwaway. I think the larger problem is, like, everything has been either aping this or influenced by this, so they've, you know, sort of taken that story and run with it, or it's, you know, just been done a billion times since then. But, yeah, the writing wasn't great, but everything else in this, all the visual, all the direction, like, top notch. Like, this is a show to watch, even if you go, oh, I don't know, it was made in, like, the late 80s, and it has that style. No, you want to watch it, because the colors, the way they interact, the shapes, the forms, the ferocity of it.
Are you saying that 80s productions are bad?
I'm saying 80s writing is bad. I'm not even saying it's bad.
I mean, Jared was saying it is quintessentially 80s, and I look at this, and I think, of course, Blade Runner, Streets of Fire. I see a lot of Schwarzenegger movies in this, Total Recall, stuff like that.
It's so
Dark
heavily,
Angel yeah. with Dolph Lundgren. It is just 80s sci-fi writing, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Send all your hate mail to Evan Minto at anigamers.com.
Oh, that's evil. How dare you let this other podcast exist? I will say, like, I'm not huge on robot-based stuff, and I'm not huge on cyberpunk in general. Good cyberpunk, yes. Like, give me a good story, like a really enthralling, original, twisty story, and I will be 100% behind this. But this I just love to watch and listen and, you know, admire happen. But the story, I couldn't really give two pennies as to where it went, just as long as I was allowed to go on for the ride.
I don't know that I can rationally defend the writing of Bubblegum Crisis. I'm too emotionally invested in it. Like, I'm going to go ahead and be upfront. But, I mean, trying to be objective about it, I mean, I think I tend to agree with Doug. It's pretty much on the level of just here's some 80s sci-fi writing. I genuinely think that there's some great episodes in it that I like as stories. But I mean, overall, the whole thing, it's not going to win, and I don't think it won any awards for writing. Of course, if it did, I would not know. But I do think that it's got some very emblematic of the cyberpunk genre kinds of stories in it. I'm thinking about Born to Kill, Revenge Road. Those episodes I thought were really, really, I thought, good stories. And I do like how it tries to tie back into some of the things that happen. It creates, even though this is sort of an episodic series, it creates some continuity. There is some connection between different story arcs in the show. Like, you know, a girl's killed in the second OAV, and her sister comes back to avenge her in the seventh OAV. That was cool. So I like how it built, even just through eight episodes, a pretty solid sense of world building, I thought, through it, especially in terms of the amount of screen time it had to do it. I felt like it was very economical with how it fleshed out the world. And, you know, you felt pretty immersed in it, or I did, at least.
I did dig the world building. I did dig the world building, because, like you said, like, nothing was, like, specifically linear. You didn't say that, but, you know, it's delivered via, you know, a number of OIVs, and it's not a straight-through story. You just follow certain characters in certain periods, and that's it. And I thought it was, when I started watching it, I thought it was going to be a straight storyline just across, you know, those OIVs. And when it wasn't, I was just like, oh, okay, well, here's this separate story and separate story and separate story. And I really enjoyed how it kept that continuity and just kept that world and kept building it. And even just like how they built Genion, not Genion.
I was waiting for somebody to do that in this show. I knew it was going to happen.
It wouldn't be the dude drinking the whiskey, now would it? I loved how they built the evil corporation little by little, because, you know, in the first OAV, there's just this, you know, okay, it's obviously an evil corporation that's now dabbling in military, and by the end of the thing, it's this like, world-threatening corporation that's
actually,
mainly
that's
military.
Actually, that's something I wanted to bring up, because I caught RoboCop again on TV the other day. Yeah, they can show it on cable now. And I realized that the Genome Corporation has a lot in common with OCP in terms of the sort of dominance that they have over their respective environments, either Megatokyo or Detroit, and just the way they throw their power around through establishing military connections, creating weapons, and just running everybody's fast. I just thought that was something that should be brought to the table, especially since I think it's episode 7 or 8 where Celia meets her contact at a movie theater, and it's showing RoboCop with what looks like a Kenichi Sonoda-styled RoboCop girl.
Oh, well, you know, that's Vision, too, right?
Yeah, I did notice that.
That's Vision in the movie.
Okay, that was episode 8, then.
Yeah, Vision's in the movie. She's in a getup that I think was a prototype for what her hard suit would have been if she had joined the Nightsabers, which is something we can talk about in a minute, but... But yeah, like they reference RoboCop in that episode. But I and RoboCop itself coming out right around the same time as Bubblegum Crisis, you know, it plays a lot of the same themes. And I thought that's a very interesting parallel to bring up. You know, that part of the 80s was like cyberpunk was a big damn deal. You know, that was where a lot of the excitement, the energy was, I think, creatively in the sci-fi space at the time.
And speaking of a lot of pop culture references like that, earlier on, they're also a lot more prevalent if you're looking very carefully. Like, they're looking at a map at one point, and all of the locations are names having to do with Top Gun.
Yeah.
there is in the episode Revenge Road with the car. Written on the car, it says Thunder Road, the name of a Bruce Springsteen single, and also Highway Star
on the bike.
The Deep Purple, yeah.
I think we
no,
got the top
it was it was my mistake. It had on the bike Highway Star and Thunder Road, and then there was the map that had all of the Top Gun names, and then my personal favorite, can't remember which episode it was. But they are either exiting or entering a parking garage. And where it would normally give the height clearance, like 10 feet or something, it says max headroom.
I totally missed that.
There was also one episode where they had – it was on one of the random – it was the random blurbs of English they would put, which this show seemed to really lovingly – like to put nonsense English on things.
Oh yeah.
But it was it started off with Madonna, and then there were just like Madonna song lyrics, like
ooh,
right here.
Yeah, I remember, but I can't remember when.
I think it was one of the earlier episodes.
There was also one in one of the later episodes where it is supposed to say lock on, obviously, but they make that mistake they made in G Gundam later on where it says rock on. It's just a lot more appropriate for Bubblegum Crisis.
Yeah. Yeah, it really references the 80s pop culture in a way that, you know, just as a reminder that so many Japanese creators really like American geeky things, just like we like Japanese geeky things. It's a cool cycle.
One that has proved mutually beneficial in many cases.
Absolutely. This, I think this show has a lot to unpack and think about in terms of, well, a range of subjects. But Ink, what strikes you about Bubblegum Crisis that you want to dig deeper on?
You know, I'm not too sure. I watched these a bit ago, and most of the stories have faded from my head. All I'm really recalling is most of the visuals.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of visuals, this show is headlined by four badass soldier girls, to coin the song in the soundtrack. You know, like, this would be like my favorite version of like Sailor Scouts would be the Night Sabers. But there is a lot of gaziness in the way they're portrayed on the screen. So one of the things about this show that I thought found challenging in kind of, now that I see male gaze more in things I watch, going back and seeing this, I was like, oh wow, okay, it has some gazy moments. Not as many as you would think, right?
Not as lurid either.
Not as lurid.
Especially once they get past the whole thing about Mackie trying to sneak peeks at his older sister.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, to be fair, he's trying to sneak peeks at everybody, but particularly the older sister. Yeah, it was weird.
And the older sister's just like, oh, you.
Yeah. I wonder why they suddenly stopped doing that. I mean, I'm not complaining. I'm just wondering why suddenly.
Someone hit the director.
Probably.
I mean, but all of them hit all of the directors with one slap, Three Stooges style.
Yeah.
They called a company meeting. All these secretaries came in the room and just went, no.
But I do think that the kind of the tension between, hey, we need to like show some fan service, but also we want these characters to be pretty badass.
And they are badass. But there was even in the first OIV, there's a moment like right after they come off the bus ride and go into the office to take this job at this for the military. They come in dressed already in their suits, and no one really expected them to come, you know, dressed all superheroed already.
Yeah.
And when they begin to speak, everyone's surprised that there are women. And I think it's Nene, actually, who comes up to one of them, nudges him in the shoulder, like just visibly just nudges him by the shoulder, not any sort of pressing of the boob against the back or anything like we're expecting of nowadays. But it's a very like aggressive sort of male gesture. Mm. And she says, hey, even with these suits of armor, can't hide these measurements, right? And she just walks right past him. And it's a very, it's assertive, it's empowered, it's not gazy. And you can't really get gazy on those suits of armor anyway. But there are, like, moments where you're watching.
I can recall some shots.
Oh, there are shots. There's Pris getting ready for the concert and getting dressed and other shots like that, but none of those really struck me as like the pandering of today.
I like, you know, this is going to sound kind of weird, but I like in that first episode where she's getting ready to perform. Yeah, it's really fan servicey, but like she's like putting on part of her costume, and like it doesn't. This is just a great spot of animation, I think. It doesn't fit like she's having to like squeeze into it a little bit, and she gets this kind of irritated look on her face, like, damn it. Get in this corset, you know? And I thought that was kind of a neat, like, authentic, like, moment, even though, yeah, it's, like, fan servicey and stuff, but,
yeah.
Well, when you talked about today, like, today is just outrageous. They use all of that to sell the Blu-rays. They have the little sun gazes on all of the perfect points that they can use to censor it and just say, hey, you want to see this? Then buy the Blu-rays, but that's not the point of this. I mean, it's sexy, sure. Hell yeah, it's sexy, but
I like a woman who can kick my ass.
Well, I'm not going to deny that, but no, that just wasn't the point. It was the whole package. It was sexy. It was violent. It was cool. It had a great sound to it. And that's all it was trying to be. It doesn't have to have, like, everything shoved right into the camera like all the TV anime is doing now. It just needed to be what it was. And in that way, it worked out perfectly.
Yeah, there's something very attractive about a woman punching a hole through a Terminator-looking giant robot thing, and it, like, exploding out the back.
Also, having it be a woman and not, say, a middle school girl or a high school girl.
Yeah, they're all of working age.
Refreshingly.
Yeah, Nene is a cop. Lena is an aerobics instructor. Celia is, her cover is a lingerie store owner. And Pris is a rock star who seems to have a residence at this one club and one club only.
Hot legs.
So let's just touch kind of quickly on the different episodes. The first one is, of course, the world establishing, character establishing, kind of establishing all of the things episode, which is Tinsel City Rhapsody. Really, this one is kind of this one is mostly just from Pris's point of view for the most part. She's very much sort of the focus in terms of being kind of the quote main protagonist, even though we're introduced to the whole team in fairly quick order. And you know, it's formulaic in that it has to establish lots of things and set up lots of things. Do you guys feel like it did that effectively with that first episode? Do you have any thoughts about that first episode in particular?
I do. I think that establishes it all really well. What's really strange, though, going off of what you said about Pris being the main character, is in any other story, Celia would be the main character, because this is all sort of her revenge story.
Yeah.
Because
she is the leader of the Nightsabers also, and the mastermind behind the suits.
And you get that air from her throughout the episode, but you're not told that.
Well, it's shown really well. That's a really good way of telling us. Like, her father, a brilliant scientist for the Genome Corporation, is killed after working on some big project. He knew it was going to happen, so he sent Celia a disc that she looked at, and it just beamed all of his blueprints and specs into her brain, and that's how she was able to come up with the Nightsaber's hard suits.
And it did so through a regular pair of audio headsets, which was really impressive.
Which, to that point, one of the things that the series plays with a little bit, and it does it really explicitly here. It does it really explicitly later in Red Eyes. But there's a bit of a suggestion that Celia and maybe Mackie are both some kind of boomer. It's never explicitly said. It's sort of it hinted at, even, is a bit strong. But there are things.
It's not like Blade Runner wasn't overt. The Final Cut wasn't overt at all about Deckard being a replicant, but it's still implied heavily enough that you can get it on your first viewing. Bubblegum Crisis. I didn't get it until years later.
Yeah, but that scene that you mentioned is kind of the first clue they drop about there's something about her that is a bit extraordinary.
And that's in the same episode where there's this little girl who is the sort of the same thing. It's like, oh, well, there's this girl who looks incredibly human, and she turns out not to be.
Yeah. Not only does she turn out not to be human, she turns out to be a child with a module in her – a boomer child with a module in her brain that allows her to control satellite laser beam weaponry, which is something we find out in the first episode is kind of a thing, basically the old 1980s, the Star Wars thing that the Reagan administration talked up as a potential deterrent to the Soviet Union, where you basically have satellite weapons that are capable of eliminating nuclear threats. They kind of take that same idea and like take it to 11 and say, let's just put giant laser beams on satellites. And we're going to, in this world, all of the countries, even like third world countries, are going to have at least one satellite that they could just, you know, hit a capital with if they wanted to. So it's a world where like there's a gun to everybody's head, like literally a gun to everybody's head that they can't even see with their own eyes, but they know it's there.
And that's why it's a great metaphor for the Genome Corporation's hold over the world.
Yeah. But yeah, the Cynthia, the little girl, has the that technology in her brain. And they kind of find that out over the course of the episode, and it's sort of a big twisting plot point. It actually leads into the second episode, which is Born to Kill, where we have basically a friend of Lena's, the aerobics instructor, is her fiance dies under mysterious circumstances, and they start investigating, and it turns out that he's tied up in this whole satellite weapon stuff too, and it's kind of got a that one was really kind of a big contrast, I think, to the first episode, because it was a much more personal story. We went into, you know, a little bit into Lena's life, you know, because she's close friends with this girl Irene, who actually ends up being killed by by a boomer woman assassin with Lady Deathstrike fingernails. For the X-Men fans out there,
her name is Madigan, which I thought may have also been a reference to Streets of Fire. Amy Madigan playing a main character in it.
Mm. But
it's interesting also that you say that was a personal story, because that and episode 7, where this all comes full circle, are Lena's only real moments, but we don't learn anything about her as a character throughout the entire series. I mean, the rest of them we get a pretty good handle on early on, but we never really get a sense of what she's about, what her motives are, anything like that.
Yeah, that's true. All we learn is like she's a really capable hand-to-hand fighter, and she's kind of fickle when it comes to dating people, and she is very interested in the amounts of money, at least early in the series. She changes a bit later, but the amount of money they're going to make off certain jobs. But that's really it. Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. So going kind of past Born to Kill, the first three episodes have some kind of thread that ties them together in the form of this satellite weapon technology and the need to acquire it. And Blow Up, the third episode, goes into that a bit more. We've been introduced to the Genom Corporation and the evil kind of chairman guy who's just this arch capitalist kind of jerk face named Quincy, and his right hand man, Brian J. Mason, who's this really creepy looking reptilian kind of looking slick back haired.
Not that kind of reptilian for the conspiracy theorists out there.
but Brian J. Mason ends up kind of being like the antagonist, really, of the first three episodes. He's manipulating things behind the scenes, trying to get his hands on the satellite technology and reclaim it, and almost gets away with it if it wasn't for those rotten ladies in battle suits. They end up killing him and preventing him from doing evil things with that satellite technology. Even though he has like a pretty decent power suit himself, it's still not as cool as what the Nightsabers are packing. I don't remember a lot about Blow Up except for the song. I liked the song, and it was decent. But I think it was probably one of the weaker episodes on its own.
It was the shortest, so it was the biggest rush from setup to action.
Yeah. Yeah, it really just didn't leave a big impression with me. Even watching it, you know, all these times later, it just doesn't ever, you know, like all the, like, oh, plot things happen. Okay.
Was it during Blow Up, or was it one of the later ones where they actually start to reference how the boomers are always shown as evolving. In the very first one, they mentioned, like, oh, this is a Class C boomer. It's totally different than the ones that preceded. But throughout the series, it actually shows them being more adept, more lethal, more human, more almost delighting in torture. And the Nightsabers don't really evolve on par with that. They keep their same suits for a longer portion of the series. Was Blow Up one of the first times that they actually advanced their suits, or was that a little later?
That was a little bit later.
Get upgraded suits in the final episode, I know that.
Yeah. Except Pris kind of gets a new hard suit early, because she's Pris, but she blows up everything she touches.
And kills everyone she gets close to. Not actually kills, but everyone she gets close to dies.
Yeah, it's I think the only one to survive her is Leon, the 80 police inspector.
Well, he's the only one that she actively avoids too.
Yeah, I think the more Pris likes you, the more of a death sentence you have, because especially if you're a motorcycle, because by the time you've gotten to Revenge Road, oh my God, she's gone. Like the part of the story arc of Revenge Road is, oh my God, Pris, will you stop wrecking things?
I love that opening sequence. That opening really sequence good. Is so wonderful.
I think that intro comes in with that song Mad Machine, and you've got the badass car, and oh, that's such a good episode. this is the Shinji Aramaki episode. There's some gorgeous, gorgeous mechanical designs throughout this episode. The car is one
that
of those
car actually reminds me a little bit of the Buff, which is Bean Bandit's car in Gunsmith Cats and Riding Bean.
I was gonna say that the Griffin, the car from Revenge Road, really makes Bean's car just look like just a pale shadow. You know, even though Bean's car is really cool, the car in Revenge Road is essentially a boomer. Like, it's souped up so much, it has basically this guy, you know, this guy's on this revenge hunt against the motorcycle gangs after they caused him to have a car accident while his I think girlfriend or fiance one is in the car with him. She's traumatized by it, and he kind of goes off the deep end, traumatized in his own way. And he starts working with the guy, or his girlfriend's father, who is this like super genius mechanic who incidentally also helps the Nightsabers with their stuff. And he builds for this guy this really amazing souped up death car that they end up souping it up so much. They put like a mental control system in the car so the guy can drive it with his mind, and the car picks up on the guy's just hatred.
It
and
goes Doc Ock from Spider-Man 2 on him.
It's sort of like the 80s movie Maximum Overdrive, you know, where ooh, the cars are killing people. Like, yeah, it's kind of that whole thing. And the car literally pretty much becomes a boomer. It, without like really taking on the anthropomorphized form, but it has one of my favorite things about this episode is the sense of malice you get from that car, and just the way the car can emote, but not in any kind of way that you would recognize as a emote from like a person, you know. It just great episode. Love that episode.
By the way, I don't know if you've ever watched ADV's release of Get a Robo Armageddon, but if they had released Bubblegum Crisis, then they would have translated the girl's trauma as being her turning autistic.
Maybe. Yeah, like She has serious issues with motorcycles ever since the accident, and kind of that triggers her anytime she sees motorcycles. And in the world of Mega Tokyo, everybody's got a motorcycle, so it's pretty debilitating. But they end up really. This is one of those missions where it kind of turns to a bit of a personal story again, not for one of the particular characters of the Night Sabers, but just the mission is a very personal one. They're asked by Dr. Raven, who's their super genius mechanic guy, to save his daughter and the boyfriend. And miraculously, which is something that rarely happens in Mobile Gun Crisis, they actually manage to save both of these people without them being killed. They do get arrested, though.
Well, after three episodes of going up against the evil corporation, I think it was a necessary switch to actually have sort of a more human story and say, okay, these aren't only, people going after the establishment. They're also people fighting for people.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to warn you, Inc., now, don't ever watch Kamen Rider, if that's what you're thinking.
Well, I mean, thinking just in terms of tone and wanting to shake things up, like, I could see it. Like, okay, we've done this before. Why don't we switch to something a little bit different? It's like, and to have, like Jared mentioned, like this inanimate objects that's suddenly taking on human emotions because of the link between the two, forcing the group of sailor scouts to deal with a very personal story, one that links to them indirectly through one of their main members' passion, which is motorcycles. It all fits a little bit well, and it just helps the story fan out a little bit and get a little easier, lessen a bit its a harsh tone, and just sort of go a little softer sci-fi.
Mm-hmm. In terms of release dates, I thought this was interesting, just how the show ends up. It starts out being the first three episodes all come out in 1987. Tinsel City Rhapsody comes out on February 25th. Born to Kill comes out later in September on the 5th. And then Blow Up comes out on the 5th of December. That three-part arc, if you will, that first initial arc, such as it is, all within 1987, all come out really kind of quickly. Revenge Road actually starts a trend that kind of becomes more elongated throughout the remainder of the series, where it didn't come out until July 24th of 1988. So big bit of a jump in time with the lead time for them to do this. And I wonder if that was sort of the start of when Art Mick and UMech start bickering over rights and money and who's making money off of what. But I just thought that was interesting.
Hard to say, but I would guess that they were just spending more time working on the individual episodes because, I mean, Tinsel City Rhapsody, still a very good episode, but it's not the most advanced animation-wise. And then you have Born to Kill and Blow Up, which are less than a half hour each.
Mm-hmm.
And so then after that, the episodes get longer and the animation gets much better.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Revenge Road is a really pretty, pretty episode.
And honestly, there's not that much difference between the release time in Tinsel City Rhapsody and Born to Kill and Blow Up and Revenge Road. About 6 months.
Oh, that's true, too. From Revenge Road, we begin sort of the second big kind of... Revenge Road really stands kind of on its own, but the second story arc, if you will... starts off with Moonlight Rambler. And Moonlight Rambler comes out December 25th, Christmas Day, 1988. So that one, probably...
It's a present.
Yeah. It's a present. It's definitely a present. And it comes out, around the same... I think, again, to your point, Inc., about the same... almost 6 months, slightly less than time span between Revenge Road and Moonlight Rambler. I like Moonlight Rambler a lot. I like Red Eyes that follows it a lot. Both of these are pretty much, I think, story-wise and direction-wise, Masami Obari's joint. I think this is pretty much his main contribution besides mechanical designs to the project overall. Moonlight Rambler actually starts out on the in space with a team of five female. We find out they are class 33 series boomers, which are basically sex androids. And sexeroids, they do call
taken yeah. straight from a Leiji Matsumoto comic from I believe the 60s.
they're trying to escape the moon, and they're being pursued by these really advanced high powered military boomers called Dobermans. All but two of the five sexeroids make it out alive, and they land in Tokyo, Mega Tokyo, and try to go to ground and obtain vital information that they can use to basically fix themselves to where they don't need to suck blood. Because, oh yeah, by the way, not only are they sex robots, they're also vampire sex robots with apparently almost all of the powers that vampires classically have, including being able to like mesmerize people with their eyes and to suck people's blood. So yeah,
but none of the
that's not
weaknesses.
Yeah,
to Wesley Snipes.
what
but, yeah, you have
think about that one.
Lesbian, vampire, sexeroids from the moon from a very high concept series. This is the most high concept episode I think there is.
This is Masami Obari being full Obari.
I as soon as I saw the blood sucking robots, I was just like, oh. And then
you
I
didn't
laughed
love
myself
that?
Silly. No, I hated I it. Then I laughed that. Myself silly thereafter. I despised the depths to which it sank, and then just languished in its insanity, and I loved
14.
It.
14-year-old me loved this so much, but it, you know, 37-year-old me, it's like, it's kind of dumb, but yeah, whatever, it's good. I don't have, you know, growing up, this was my favorite. Like this and Red Eyes were my favorite, and I still have a lot of affection for them. But to your earlier point, Ink, about like quality of story, I mean, this was pretty. This was like, you know, CW level kind of sci-fi.
That first death scene where they're escaping, and I forgot the exact series of events, but there were two people behind a door, like in an escape pod, that were supposed to be waiting for the friends, but the friends cut them off. And they just stand there behind the door for like ever, listening to their friends die. And I'm just like, man, why haven't you gone yet? They've locked the door. There's no chance. Just go. No. Just listening to the torture porn of it all, like, happening in the next room. Just like, man.
Yeah. Not the most strongly written episode, for sure. It did have, for my money, probably the best mecha design in the whole series, in the form of the DD Battle Mover. That thing was insane. Oh God, I love that thing.
What was the DD Battle Mover?
The DD Battle Mover was this super powerful military power suit thing that Sylvie
piloted.
And she ends up, you know, mysterious girl shows up in town. Of course, because, you know, why not? She instantly becomes very close friends with Pris. And
very close
friends. Yeah. And
they make that joke.
They do. Mm-hmm. They do. one of the funnier moments in that was like when, like, Lena was kind of sort of jealous that this new girl had come into town and Pris was spending all this time with her, and she was kind of bitching about it a little bit. And it's like, she can't be all that in a bag of chips. I mean, not exactly, you know, what she says, but, and then she comes in, and then like Lena's like super polite to her. Like, oh, hello. How are you? Oh, you know, just, it's really funny. Kind of moment, but
the duality anyway. Of man.
Yeah. Back to Awesome Mecha, DD Battle Mover. So amazing. So amazing.
And also, this was the first time we see anyone in the AD police using a pilotable robot when we see Leon try and fight it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Leon hops in a K-12, and which is the AD police really clunky, nowhere near as advanced as it needs to be to stand a chance battle suit. And
it looks nothing like it, but it reminds me a little bit of the football armor from MD Geist. Which I don't know if it was this episode, but Koichi Ohata did work on Bubblegum Crisis mm-hmm. at some point.
Yeah, and it could be that he had a hand in the design for that. It reminded me of the it's more armored, but it reminded me of the power loader thing from Aliens.
Oh yeah,
a bit. The suit is like way outclassed by the DD Battle Mover, which the whole AD police thing and the kind of the running joke the Nightsabers make about the AD police is, you know, they're too far up their own ass to do anything for the people. And the more practical concern that Leon often poses is, A, they have to stay within the law, and B, they have nowhere near enough money to deal with all of the boomer crime that they're having to deal with. So they Leon is sort of like the Commissioner Gordon of Bubblegum Crisis. You know, he's the guy who, like, you know, publicly would never be in favor of vigilante justice, but, you know, privately is all too happy to let the Nightsabers go in and help clean up some of the mess.
I would have compared him more to Riggs from Lethal Weapon. In fact, the entire infrastructure of the AD police is very reminiscent of every 80s cop sort of story there is. You have Leon, the really hot-headed, like, for justice cop. You have his partner, Daley Wong, who we find out in the last episode is his roommate, which is funny because throughout the entire series, he keeps making these passes at him. And Leon has no idea what he means. And then you have the chief, whose name I can't remember, who is the typical, like, overweight, angry black guy who's screaming, "You're a loose cannon, you can't be doing that."
See, I was thinking more of Leon as the as that one dude from Cat's Eye, but in a stronger, less inept role, because...
I'm happy you said less than F. That's a well, huge yeah. difference.
Oh, huge. Because, you know, while he's underarmed, like you guys said, and while he actually does reference the fact that, hey, you know, we don't stand a chance with the money and the technology we have, he at least does well causing some diversions at some points. He's very tactical in how he can employ what he can and cannot use. And does manage to help out a little bit in certain situations, but is still very notably a support for the main cast of female characters, which is kind of cool. Whereas, yeah. you know, the person in Cat's Eye almost has the same exact role. He's doting on one of the, you know, the Supergirls, but, you know, he is just this love-soaked fool who has no clue or capabilities whatsoever and is outclassed in everything. And I really liked Leon's sort of supportive role in this.
Yeah, he was able to appear competent but not overshadowing the Nightsabers. Mm. And for the time that this came out, that's pretty unique, I think, in a lot of ways.
I'd say it's more unique in the fact that he was not just a straight up bumbler.
Mm. That too.
Like, a lot of the times you see all female cast very competent, and you see the male side character who's always a total Gomer Pyle type. But no, he is very helpful. He's able to get information whenever Nene can't, which is her main role in the Nightsabers. And
comedic relief.
Yeah, and he is able to provide a lot of side help for the Night Sabers in getting barricades, getting foot soldiers into the battlefield in order to clear some space, buy some time, all that sort of stuff.
This episode, you know, ends with Leon almost being killed by Sylvie in the DD Battle Mover, who by the time the fight's progressed to a certain stage, the DD Battle Mover has kind of taken over and Sylvie can't control it anymore. She's sort of stuck in there, trapped. Pris has to make the very difficult decision to kill her friend to keep her from killing Leon and, you know, who knows how many other people if she's not stopped. And the follow-up to Moonlight Rambler is Red Eyes, which that is August 30th, 1989. That comes out, so a bit longer of a time frame for them to put that one together, and it shows because it's really pretty. Red Eyes directly follows the events of Moonlight Rambler. There's almost no time lost in there. I think it may be a couple of days, if that. Leon's still recovering from his wounds. Pris is still really devastated at the loss of her friend, and actually even to the point where she's going to quit the Night Sabers, kind of just in the depths of her grief. The plot of Moonlight Rambler and Red Eyes, there's sort of a mastermind behind it all, this enigmatic guy named Largo, who by the time things kind of hit the fan in Red Eyes, we find out he is a very powerful, very advanced super boomer, capable of – he kind of has the perfected version of the satellite weapon technology that made its appearance early in the first couple episodes. And he is trying to get his hands on something called the Overmind Control System, which is something that the Genom Corporation has, that the CEO, Quincy, has been jealously guarding. And Largo's whole – you know, raison d'etre is to get a hold of the Overmind Control System and, you know, with that, take over the world and be able to control just all of the boomers everywhere and everything that Genom is plugged into. This was a really, really cool, very action-heavy, again, Masami Obari joint, extremely action-heavy. Pris ends up fighting, you know, kind of, you know, doing the maverick thing that she likes to do and going off on her own. And this time it almost gets her killed. But the team shows up to sort of bail her out at the last minute with a slightly upgraded hard suit. And they manage to defeat Largo in the most improbable anime victory I can think of, you know, in terms of like, there's lots of improbable anime victories, but this was the really, really improbable one. They basically shoot a laser up into the atmosphere at a satellite and deflect, then change the angle of the satellite laser beam just enough for it to hit Largo and kill him.
That's not what kills him.
Oh, wait. Didn't Leon shoot him?
Or something, yeah, like that? One last bullet between the eyes from Leon.
Yeah. Which is the only time I think he ever comes in and like does the finishing blow on it for any episode. Which, and now that you mention that, I really hated that when I saw it. I'm like, why did that have to happen that way?
I love that. It finally gave him some finality in any story.
Yeah.
Also, he's still just supporting because like all that other work to do that laser beam realignment thing, like, and all he has to do is walk up and go, poof. Okay, well, you finished them all. All right.
Yeah, I thought it would have been, well, like, knowing what I know, having watched it, so many times, I would have liked, the story person in me would have liked Celia to have finished him off, but Largo is ridiculously powerful boomer who almost has some sort of, he almost displays, like telekinesis type powers at different points. It's really ridiculous, but yeah, the most powerful boomer in the whole series is eventually killed by the
his own hand. Dude.
Well, yeah, and the laser beam. the big reveal with Largo though is that he turns out to be and they he's sort of psychically aware of Celia Stingray somehow. And she's sort of psychically aware of him through the Force or something. It's never very well explained. But it turns out that he is actually Brian J. Mason in a super boomer body. And we find that out right at the very end of the episode, even though they kind of hint at it a little bit with things that Largo says and kind of his whole plan and everything. Anyway, I feel like I've talked a lot about these episodes that I love so much. So you guys talk and I'm going to shut up.
Okay, now it's time to fill our eyes with double vision.
Double vision.
Oh, you knew I was going there.
Of course.
This is... Yeah?
I was going to say... I wasn't going to talk. But one thing about this whole episode is that by the time that Red Eyes was in the works, the actress who was also the musician who played Pris wanted to pursue her music career and wanted to leave the show. And they were going to kill off Pris in this battle with Largo. But the kind of rumor of that, apparently, and this has all kind of been just talked about through the fandom through the years, so like I don't have like a specific like issue of Anime Age to reference here, but apparently the fan reaction to Pris being written out of the show was such a huge there was so much blowback from it that they actually changed course and managed to work out something to keep her with the series. And you also start seeing more of the Nightsabers, like all four of the Nightsabers singing songs instead of just her by the midpoint of the series, which has something to do with this too. So they were going to write Pris out of the show and they were going to replace her with Vision. But since that didn't happen, they kind of changed what they were going to do with Vision to kind of write her as kind of a guest starring role. But the final episode where she shows up as she's in that RoboCop movie, the suit she's wearing is concept art from her hard suit that she would have worn if she was going to have joined the Nightsabers. Hmm. Now I'll shut up.
Okay, so in this one, it starts out with a concert in America for a musician named Vision, who has a lot of parallels with Pris in terms of musical style, personality. And then we see an attack made on an American corporation who is doing business with Genome by a huge spider mech. I can't remember the name of it, but it attacks them and word spreads back to Quincy in Japan. So he braces for it. All the while, Vision starts to tour Japan, goes there a week early. And soon we're seeing a whole lot more attacks on Genome buildings, trying to kill certain executives. And then we find out that this is all just one big ruse, the musical tour. Vision is working with her family, her family's crime syndicate, in which they are trying to get revenge for Irene's death, the friend of Lena's who was murdered by Madigan in episode 2. And all hell just breaks loose from there.
Honestly, the thing I remember most about this episode was just how catty the envy was between Vision and Pris. I just loved that humanization of her to that level, because she'd just been the strong, very defensive person up until that point, and that enviousness, that jealousy, just sort of brought a real human side to her that I thought was lacking throughout the entire thing. Like, even through the faux lesbian approaching the scenes, it never really came through that she was actually had human feelings. Like, this kind of put it in because it was a negative context for me, and I mm-hmm. loved seeing that side of her. But
I don't know that I would agree that Pris didn't have like real human feelings, so to speak, but I do like that it rounded out her feelings more, because you know, I forget which episode it is, but it's one of the earlier ones where maybe it's Blow Up, where there's this little boy that lives in her apartment complex.
It's Blow Up, yeah.
And there's the mom, and she sort of looks after the little boy while the mom's working, and you know, she goes to the little boy's birthday and celebrates the birthday and all that. But beyond that, a lot of what you see from Pris is basically Batman, you know, outside of that one episode where they do humanize her a bit. But it is, I mean, it is one episode amidst, you know, eight where she's pretty much just, you know, kicking A all the time, and that's really kind of her main job. So I have no complaints
about that job.
Yeah, I do agree that like her having that sort of petty sort of envy of Vision, and like Vision's like global, you know, superstardom and everything, was a really neat way to route to kind of speak back to her, you know, more modest career and like, you know, round her character out a little bit. I thought that was cool.
It also speaks to her, you know, her thoughts on leaving the
Nightsabers.
Thank you.
I didn't want to hear you say Sailor Scouts again.
I wasn't going to revert to that, but yeah, it does speak to Pris, you know, contemplating leaving the Nightsabers again, because it's like, oh well, hey, you know, I was good at that. I'm better than her at that, and that's almost a direct parallel. It's like, I don't want anyone taking my spot in the Nightsabers. Like, I'm the best there. Like, I'm the leader. Like,
yeah. I really I like both the Vision songs. I enjoy those when I have the opportunity to listen to Bubblegum Crisis music. And I liked the Spider Tank, which I know that's, I mean, we've seen Spider Tanks in so many things through the years, but I thought that version of it was really cool.
I really like how the legs folded up so that it could move into compact areas.
Yeah, it's probably one of the most well thought out spider tanks we've ever seen.
Not as good as a shark on top of mechanical legs, though.
Oh no, there's no beating that. Yeah, there's all the mecha design, you know, almost Dead Leaves quality, I would say.
Almost. Not as colorful.
Not as colorful. Nowhere near as colorful. And now we have, again, fulfilled our mission to reference Dead Leaves podcast that we have never released yet again.
And hopefully never will.
Maybe as a punishment to our fans. You know, the two of them. All right. Well, the last episode in Bubblegum Crisis's run, Double Vision came out in March 14th of 1990.
My birthday. Whoop, whoop.
Hey, you had a
My birthday was exactly a year before.
Oh, you mean like your birthday, like your first birthday. Oh, okay. Like day zero.
Mm-hmm.
I feel old.
I thought that was just a really good joke.
So we don't get the final episode of Bubblegum Crisis until almost a year later, in January 30th of 1991. We get Scoop Chase, which is very different from the prior seven episodes. It is a Nene focused episode entirely.
Thank God. And
it's actually really great. It's very much like Nene. It's very upbeat and positive.
A lot of people really like to talk down this episode, but I like it a lot as It's just character moments. That's all the episode is. And when you have a series that's balls to the walls action, then that's like the cake for your icing.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are certain episodes of Gal Gigar that I really love just because they slow down a bit and give us a chance to learn more about the characters. And that's exactly what Scoop Chase is.
Because everyone else has really gotten their episode until now, except for maybe the aerobics instructor. But Nene has always just sort of been in there as either comedic relief or a plot point. And she never really got flushed out. This is
I disagree. I thought she had her whole motivation and mindset established throughout the entire series. She is the informant. She is the more lackadaisical one. She is the more flirty of all of them.
Yeah, but she doesn't really get an episode. She's not really the
Who gets an episode in it? Unless you want to say, like, every episode is Pris's episode. That's kind of true.
I mean, honestly, like, Celia, they kind of, addition by subtraction, give Celia a focus because she's tied into all the Brian J. Mason Largo plot thread stuff, like pretty centrally, even though Pris is typically the person that's breaking all the rules and showing up in so many of the scenes. But we don't really ever get a full episode about Celia. We do kind of get an episode. We get two episodes really that focus on Lena quite a bit, the Born to Kill and Double Vision. And then, I think my viewpoint's kind of between the two of you guys. Like, until Scoop Chase, even though we do, like, Nene's character is established, you know, throughout the series, she never really has a chance to shine. She's always kind of in the background. And she's, you know, got a couple of moments before that, but I really
never in combat.
Never in combat. And she gets to be the hero. Like, she really gets to be the hero in this episode. And all of the other Night Sabers have had that chance. And we finally get it with Scoop Chase and Nene. And does anybody else want to talk about the setup for this one? Because I feel like I've been talking way too much.
Yeah, sure. I can take this one. So what happens is it starts out with a battle. And Pris finds out that they are being photographed. And so she chases after the photographer. It turns out to be a girl in high school who wants to be a photojournalist. Pris smashes her camera. And so in revenge, she wants to unmask the Night Sabers. And then we cut to the AD police precinct. And the very angry chief calls over Nene. For once, he's not angry. And he says, "This is my niece. She wants to be a photojournalist. Will you please show her around, escort her, and hopefully she can get that scoop that she so desires?" And so she is shadowing Nene, despite the fact that Nene has to split from work all the time in order to go hunt boomers.
Well, that's, you know, why she wants to shadow, or that's why she's happy shadowing Nene, because, you know, she always goes to cover the boomer stuff. And, you know, that's opportunity for her, because who...
It's a sitcom plot.
Well, yeah. Who confronts the boomers but the Night Sabers? So, opportunity presents itself. And I really just love how stupid and angsty that teenage character is. It's like, "You broke my camera, now I'm gonna unmask you. Oh yeah, all the Night Sabers do is cause all this wanton to destruction at the during the battles with the boomers and blah 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 blah." She gets so uptight. Dude, she just broke your camera. It's okay. They're saving the world.
Well, she does say that the camera was a keepsake that her dad, who is a well-established photojournalist, gave to her. But one thing I picked up on her design is that she reminded me a lot of Rally from Gunsmith Cats.
Mm.
I don't know if it was just the tan or what, but that, along with the Kenichi Sonoda design, really reminded me of that.
Yeah, This episode was directed by Hiroaki Goda, who was the all of the All My Goddess stuff ever. And I feel like I've seen – I would probably need to go back and see some All My Goddess, and I don't have any particular desire to do that anytime soon. But it really – it feels directorially quite different from some of the other episodes too, kind of in a different way than Revenge Road did, but just as Revenge Road feels a bit different from the other episodes, this one definitely seems to have a different directorial sensibility to it in the way that the characters are portrayed, and there's a lot of playful like girl time, like hanging out kind of antics, you know, usually at Nene's expense, because the whole point of this episode is Nene has a really bad couple days, and you know, the climax of course is her like turning that situation around, and she gets to be the hero for once and stops the 80 police building from blowing up at the end. And as a final episode for Bubblegum Crisis, it's a really odd note for to end on, but it you know, again, they planned for 13 episodes, they got 8, and
it wasn't planned to be the final episode. That's the problem.
Yeah, it was not planned to be the final episode. This was kind of the let's take a break from the serious stuff before we dive back in.
And honestly, I'm fine with it not feeling like a final episode, like they didn't rush right into it, because they could have done like what they usually do with a lot of anime productions is they take the finale they had planned and they just rush right into that. That was what killed the Captain Harlock cartoon from the 80s.
Mm.
In terms of plot, because it was getting canceled.
Yeah, I don't know. In some alternate reality, some parallel Earth, there's a 13-episode run of Bubblegum Crisis, and I would be intrigued to see what that would have been like if it had, you know, a little bit more tranquility to it, if the production companies didn't bicker over it so much, if there could have been some more stability with Kinoko Omori and her career and wanting her not wanting to do, you know, leave the show and things like that. They just to talk quickly about kind of the legacy or like whatever the other spinoffs around Bubblegum Crisis. We do end up getting a sequel in the form of Bubblegum Crash, which is a 3 OAV series that comes out between 1991 and 1992. It is definitely not as good as Bubblegum Crisis was. It tries to kind of tie up the series in a way, and it does have references back to the original Bubblegum Crisis series. We also have kind of a parallel series, the 80 Police Files, which is 3 OAVs. Those actually start coming out at 1990 and 1991, so they come out towards the end of the Bubblegum Crisis or eight episode run, but before Crash a little bit. And the 80 Police Files is like a prequel to Bubblegum Crisis. It talks about the early career. It focuses on Leon. It's sort of his early career. And it's not bad. It's not like great, but it's got some interesting stories in it. I think the first one is fairly interesting about a guy who's replaced basically replaced all of his organs and everything with cybernetics, except for his tongue. And he sort of goes crazy because he's become a machine, but he's, you know, he can still bite his tongue. So that's how he knows he's still alive. It's really weird. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I remember it being decent. There was then the Bubblegum Crisis 2040 reboot, which happened in the late 90s, 1998, 1999. Oh, God.
It happened. That's all that needs to be said.
it happened, and it is a very 90s show. Some, like, you know, the
very
opening.
90s remake about a very 80s show.
Yes.
Which was the exact problem that I had with Dirty Pair Flash. It was just so rooted in the time that it was created that they made a remake that was very much rooted in the time it was being created and just messed with the formula.
Yeah.
Also, I have to confess, that's the only follow-up to Bubblegum Crisis that I've seen is 2040. And I really would like to see 80 Police Files, the original one, not the 180V released, and crash at some point.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth, if you like Bubblegum Crisis, it's worth checking out. One thing about Bubblegum Crash is that a different voice actress and musician plays the role of Pris. Kinoko Omori does move on after the conclusion of Bubblegum Crisis. Unfortunately, you know, at least in the research I did for the episode, I was kind of curious, like, did she go on to have like a really long career or anything? It doesn't seem like it, unfortunately, which is a shame because she's a talented singer. And I'm not just saying that because she's in one of my favorite anime.
Oh no, she is a great singer.
Yeah, I mean she was amazing, and but it looks like her band, you know, they put out some more stuff in the early 90s, but they kind of fade from the pages of history shortly after that. The band's name is Silk. If you ever want to try to do some research on them yourselves, the only other thing, the only other spinoff. Is there was a set of three OVAs in 2003 called Parasite Dolls, which is set in the Bubblegum Crisis universe. I have not ever seen it. I don't think it has any – I don't know that it references the Night Sabers at all, but it's more stories with boomers, I think. So I might want to check that out sometime just to – you know, be a completionist about it. In terms of other things that you've seen over the years of Bubblegum Crisis, you know, Bubblegum Crisis was popular enough in the 90s, and fellow old takus out there will certainly remember hearing about it, at least if they didn't see it. There was a original graphic novel released in the West by Dark Horse Comics called Bubblegum Crisis Grand Mall. It was done by Adam Warren, who, tying back to Doug's earlier thoughts about Dirty Pair, he did the Dirty Pair adaptation over here too. There was a Bubblegum Crisis RPG that came out by R. Talsorian Games, and this is probably going to be way inside baseball, but for you gamer nerds out there, it was powered off the Fusion system, which was a sort of D20 based system. Really cool. I played in a campaign in it right when it came out. I was, you know, me and my friends were super, super, super excited to get our hands on the game. And at one point, I owned all the supplements. Unfortunately, they weren't bound very well, and they fell apart. But if you backed the Kickstarter, you got PDF copies of all that stuff. So I do have those again. Yes. And
getting back to Grand Mal also.
Yeah.
This was before Adam Warren became known for his fish lips character designs, so he was still still objectively good. And also a lot of the character characters' personalities were very different. Like Pris was not a pop rock singer. She instead was a very angry speed metal performer.
I would have loved to have seen that.
It's still, you can still find copies of Grand Mal out there.
I think he's saying he wants that animated.
Yeah.
Oh, he wants that animated. Well, who knows? It's a crazy world, man. I used to say, oh, that'll never happen in anime, but no, I mean, we just got Masaki Yuasa doing Devilman. Anything's possible. the other thing I wanted to mention really quickly is there was a collectible card game. This is peak 90s shit here, people. So there was a collectible anime card game called Anime Mayhem that was released by Pioneer and Upper Deck in 1996. Wow. And it was sort of a forerunner to the game called Vice Schwartz that people play a lot now, in that it has multiple tie-ins from all kinds of different franchises. So Anna Mayhem came out, you had Bubblegum Crisis characters mixed in with Tenchi Muyo characters, mixed in with
Garfield, and I'm there.
El Hazar. I mean, like, everything that was popular that mainly Pioneer and some and a couple of other places did in the mid-90s.
MD Geist?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Is MD Geist in there? I don't know. I don't remember.
Fun fact.
They did.
Yeah, fun fact there. During 1 week in 1996, I wish I could find the sales chart. A friend of mine is an archivist, showed it to me. MD Geist 2, Death Force, was in the top 20 or 30 best-selling VHS tapes in America.
I believe it. I mean, that was like, that was pretty popular as intense anime action, like the kind of manga video type anime that you would see back in those days, you know? Maybe it was them that put it out. I don't even remember. but, yeah. So, Bubblegum Crisis, lots of weird tie-ins. that I, you know, wanted to mention because it really is a formative anime for a lot of people that grew up, you know, as teens in the 90s. We started getting it here a couple years after it had concluded in Japan. So probably 92, 94, somewhere in that range, it started coming out. And really, it was one of the, I think, a formative anime for a lot of people. So if you liked Bubblegum Crisis and once you listen to the show, send us your thoughts on it on Twitter, which we'll talk about where to find us later. But yeah, definitely reach out about it.
Oh, and speaking of which, we have Twitter questions.
We do. Okay, first up from Vinny of AGC, a good friend of the podcast. Best song, and is this Ink's first Obari? What about it, gentlemen? What's the best song?
Oh my god. I mean, I really, that's hard. I really like Konnyawa Hurricane, obviously. Doug, how about you?
Yeah, that's especially tough. Hurricane has probably the best spot in my mind, the biggest space in my heart, because it was the opening. It was the first song that was playing in the show when they were in the introduction in the first episode. They're just showing this big rock concert happening, big hair, lasers everywhere, and then suddenly robots are blowing things up. and you have Mr. Dandy, Mad Machine, so much good stuff. But
Mr.
Dandy's
so great because it sounds like a Japanese Michael Bolton singing a song. It's fantastic.
I would also have to go with Hurricane. It's totally the introduction.
In terms of just a song to listen to, I think I am going to have to go with Rock Me, which was the song that played right at the ending credits to
Red Eyes.
Yeah, Red Eyes. Yeah. Right after the big reveal about Brian Mason. So you are shocked about that. And then suddenly this hard rocker comes in and it just elevates the mood. And on top of that, it's also just the kind of song that gets you pumped right before a workout or something.
Yeah. Burning Highway is also really good, which I think is the start of Revenge Road.
That would make sense.
Ink, was this your first Obari?
This was indeed my first Obari.
Oh, wow. Thoughts on Obari, Inc.?
I'd actually want to go back to something you said earlier when you said the best mech.
The DD Battle Mover?
Yes. I'd actually argue, I'd say my favorite mech design in this entire thing is that first mech that appears, because it is so beautifully ugly and it's like prototypical design. It has those little sensors wiggling out of its eyes that you get the feeling is sort of like for speed and wind and whatever, but it just looks weird and is awesomely inhuman. But they're just these big Goliath-like machines that are human, but you know, have these just really weird things. And it's got a great sort of organic-inorganic thing happening, as opposed to sort of the more experimental designs that come a little later that just seem a little more out there mech-y. I liked how they toyed with the human interaction early on and just the ugliness of it. The things got a little too beautiful at the end, but I enjoyed them all. But yeah, just the early designs of the early robots were really cool for me.
If you really want to experience Obari, though, like pure, undistilled Obari, then you're going to want to watch Fight Ixer 1, or if you're feeling especially daring, Angel Blade.
That's a lot of Obari goodness.
So it's a lot of something, I'll say that.
You can probably, I mean, just watch the fights, man. Just watch the fights.
Also Fatal Fury, like you said before.
Yeah, Fatal Fury, the motion picture is so good. Oh, like if you like Masabi Obari, it's really, it's really good. But those were some strong recommendations also. Yeah. Oh, God bless Obari.
By the way, I liked how in the credits for Moonlight Rambler and Red Eyes, they wrote his name with an apostrophe after the O, like he's Irish or something.
Oh, it's Obari, son.
You want to check out my cartoon about robots and women who fight robots? It's got a great soundtrack.
We did get one more Twitter question from our friend Corey at Impassionate K on Twitter. He asks, when is The Great Passage coming out?
Which I'll say, trick question. It came out in 2016 and is available through Amazon Prime right now.
And that is the sound of ink dunking on Corey. Yeah, no, go check out The Great Passage. Everybody should go check out The Great Passage. And Dead Leaves.
Don't check out Dead Leaves.
Get around to Dead Leaves.
I think not.
But Great Passage is available on Amazon Prime now. Anime Strike has died a quiet death, and all of that stuff that was locked up, all of that goodness is now available. If you have an Amazon Prime subscription, I highly recommend that you guys go check out Great Passage. Maybe if enough of you mention that you've seen The Great Passage and would like to hear a podcast about it, we might consider releasing that podcast. I mean, I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. It's a crazy place, this world. Anyway, just throwing that out there. Guys, we've talked a lot about Bubblegum Crisis, which has mostly involved me running my mouth. Let's hear y'all's kind of summary thoughts on the show. And let's start with our guest, Mr. Doug.
Bubblegum Crisis. It is perfect. It is pure undistilled 80s. It is action, robots, explosions, rock and roll, hot women, kicking ass in robots, fighting robots with rock and roll playing. It is the best thing ever, possibly. Watch it if you haven't. And if you're listening to this, I hope to God you watched it, because we spoiled the whole damn thing.
It is 80s nostalgia to the nines. It's got a fantastic dub, and they even redubbed all the songs, and they were fantastic as well. None of this is not worth your watch. And, like, they're what, 30, 40 minutes max a piece?
Yeah.
And this is coming from the guy who I kicked off my show because he doesn't like robots.
Yeah, and it's not even, like, full-on it's not, like, mech robots. It's just, you know, like, battle robots versus women in battle suits, which is, you know, cool.
It's like a sexier Iron Man.
There you go. Watch Sexy Iron Man of the 80s. I was very happy you guys dragged me into this.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad that you made it through, and it wasn't a painful experience, because I know we do robot shows occasionally on Otaku No Radio, and I was really happy that that you were willing to do this one.
Nay, nay, forever.
Yeah. Amen to that. I think I had crushes on all four of the Night Sabers at one point, and Vision, and Sylvie.
Pris kicks ass. I love Pris. I love her to death.
She is my favorite, I think, of overall, just because, I mean, we spend so much time with her, but you know, she's a rock star with a battle suit that fights robots at night. That's like her side gig. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
But she performs at night too.
Yeah, she does all at of her night, jobs at the at same
night,
time.
She is a rock and roll megastar, but at night she plays robots.
I think this is just such a great show to really, if you want to see something that's quintessentially an 80s anime, if you want to see something that's very much steeped in the ideas and the sociocultural forces of its time, if you want to see just a badass show about four kick-ass Night Saber hard suit wearing, you know, ass kicking ladies, watch the show. I mean, it's
not a crime to say that it's sexy. Come on.
It is very much so. The suits are sexy somehow. It's crazy. It's really weird.
Thing for aluminum, admit it.
But
you should see his microwave.
Just don't smell it.
So this show's great. Check it out. On to where we can find everybody. Doug, where can we find you on the interwebs and beyond? Please, please pimp all of your stuff.
Okay. I can be found at whichever anime convention will let me present my panels, which isn't many because a lot of them contain footage from Violence Jack. But you can listen to me on iTunes. My show is Animated Action. You can find it on spaceoperasatellite.com/animated-action. You can find me on Twitter at BuddyCopDoug or at Animated Action. You can find it on Tumblr at animated-action.tumblr.com. Or if you are in the Westchester area, you can listen to me direct on the radio at WCHEAM.
Awesome. Thank you, man. Ink, where can the world find you?
At Animated Ink on the Tweety Box. Then, let's see, Old Taku no Radio. I'm a co-host, thanks to the glorious ambitions of my other co-host, Jared Nelson.
Ah, screw that guy.
Otaku USA Magazine, otakuusamagazine.com. You can go there, subscribe, get some paper in your hands of reviews that you would never have sought out by yourself but might enjoy otherwise. You can find me over at Taiku Podcast, where we just did a two-part podcast about recovery of an MMO junkie and Tukar, because I am their official bad sports anime correspondent. FandomPost.com, I have a review of Two Heart 2 coming up for whatever reason. And, there's some other place, probably. Oh, Crunchyroll Features, I pop on every occasionally and give them something. How about you, Jared?
You can find me sort of on Twitter right now at Save versus Jared. Can occasionally find written words by me that aren't in crayon on anagamers.com. I have been away from the writing scene for a little bit while I've got a lot of things going on in the world, but I'm hoping to get back to that some more in 2018 as my schedule allows. And also doing gaming blogging on Electrum Edition. There is some content up there that's worth reading right now. It's a bit old. I'm working on some more stuff, and hopefully we'll have that up sometime soon. I feel like I say that every podcast, but I am working on it. And that's pretty much it for me.
Well, thank you guys for being on and talking awesome robot designs and 80s music.
Dude, that's all you had to say. You didn't even have to tell me we were doing Bubblegum Crisis.
I'm just so happy we finally got to cover this show I love so much. So thank you, Doug, for being on, and thank you, Inc., for putting up with my request.
My pleasure. My legitimate pleasure.
Thank you.
So for Inc., for myself, for our guest, Doug, thank you very much for listening to this episode of commemorating the 30th anniversary of Bubblegum Crisis. And we hope to see you back again next month, where we will be in our February episode talking with our friend Helen of the OASG about both seasons of The Eccentric Family. So look forward to that, and we will see you soon. Something I've really looked forward to as I'm burping a lot. I'm going to have to get a lot of air out of my lungs.
Kickstart my heart, hope it never stops. Whoa.
That's our official storyline, I think, for Old Talker to Radio right now, is our Great Passage podcast that we have guarded closely like some treasure hoard.
Lady! I with the wings and the flapping and the mutilation.